it's quite idealistic about a lot of things. And my friends would often say, oh, well, if you think that, then why don't you, donate all of your money to people living in Africa? If I have some idealistic comment about, everyone deserves a good quality of life, or something like that. And so this was meant to be a reductio, or just to shut me up. But I started thinking about it is that actually I should have to take this challenge seriously. If I really did think, people were created equal, then what does follow from all of this? Is it the case that if I'm living a relatively rich life, I have to do something to help people for it myself? And how far does this argument go? Exactly what follows from this? And I started thinking about what could I do? So if I really want to achieve these things to help people, how could I do so? And in thinking about this, I divided my life up into these four categories of different ways in which I could help. So one of them was through voluntary work. So I could volunteer in different ways, volunteering say homeless shelters in the UK, or for NGOs working to help people in poor countries. Maybe I could volunteer in a poor country. I could think about my career. How much good could I do? Hoping to become a researcher in moral philosophy, thinking about ethics, which maybe a lot of people think career in philosophy could be pretty useless. I thought, no, it should actually be somewhat useful because you could try to answer questions like this and then spread the word about it and come up with nice, powerful arguments. And I think I was right about that, but that's another sector where I'm using good. Another one is in personal relationships. That's what a lot of people focus on, trying to help out their partner and their children, their family, those they know. But I think that's ultimately an area where I wouldn't go to help all that much compared to how I can help in these other areas. Although the ways I would help would be very special to me and to those around. And another one is through donations. So trying to think about if I was just to donate money that I've earned through my career. In some ways, this follows from the career. One thing I can do in my career is earn more money, and then I can donate it to try to help people in need. And you often hear some very impressive statistics for that. So I wanted to follow through with it and see, well, if I really wanted to donate a whole lot of money, what's the most I could achieve if I really wanted to do this? So I sat down and tried to find out how much I would earn as an academic and worked out that it was around about £1.5 million over my career. I encourage you to do things like this sometimes. Not many people actually go that step and say, how much would that cost? If I want to have a child, how much does that tend to cost? These types of questions. It turns out there are answers. Not that hard to find using Google. So I then had a bit of a go at calculating how much I would need to live off. So the standard I set for this was I was living as a graduate student in Oxford at the time and having quite a good life and living on, that was about £12,000 per annum. It's a little bit complicated to work out as I was only around for 10 months of the year, so I had to pro rata and things like that. But it was something in the order of £10,000 per annum. And I worked out that over my life, I would only need about £500,000 to live out the rest of my life on that kind of level. And I'd be able to, at that level, have a very good and fulfilling life. I would be able to spend a lot of time with my wife and with my good friends, listen to a whole lot of fantastic music that I really like, read the greatest books that have ever been written, engage in a whole lot of activities with my friends, talk about really exciting things, generally participate in social life. And I think that pretty much all the things that we really think are important in life, I was actually having and were able to have without a huge amount of money. I mean, I can come to it, so 500,000 wouldn't quite be enough to factor in children, so I can talk about that later. But it wouldn't need to change a lot much. Basically, the answer is that I could donate about £1 million if I don't have any children. Or about £900,000 if I have a child, or £800,000 if I have a child. It doesn't change the story very much. So I thought about this, what could I do with the remaining £1 million? It's quite fun if you think about it like that, if you do it all at once, and you think, wow, instead of a little bit here and a little bit there, donating, try to think, well, if there's actually this much that I could donate, it's really worth checking out where to give it, and not just to the first person who asks. And there's many ways that I can help people. And so a few examples are education, empowerment, peace. But in this talk, I'm going to focus on health, as it's a way that's plausibly one of the most effective, and there's also very good data for it. That doesn't mean it's the best, though, and we can talk about that in the comments afterwards. But it's at least some way that you can really see some strong evidence. And if these other things can be even more effective in health, then the conclusions I reach in this talk are going to be even stronger. So that's something where, you know, that would just make my argument stronger if health is the most effective thing to focus on. So then if we're wondering, like this type of question, how many lives do I save? There's a question about global health. There's a question about what metric to use to really be thinking about it. So one way to look at this is to look at different charities and look at the percent that they spend on overheads for administration. You will have often seen these numbers where people will say, you know, 93% of our money goes directly on programs, only 7% goes on administration, something like that. But it turns out that what the charity does with their program is much more important than exactly how much it spends on the administration and overheads. So you will see in a moment that it's very common for the programs one charity is doing to be twice as effective as those another is doing. And then it doesn't really matter whether you spend 93% of your money on the one that is only half as effective, or 80% on the one that is twice as effective. That would actually do a lot more good. So it turns out this exact question as to whether they spend 80 or 90% on the programs is really a secondary consideration compared to where they actually spend the money. And the real question that we want to know is, for a given donation, how much benefit do people receive? There's a lot of research on this, and it really matters what intervention is being performed. So not just whether they're focusing on, say, development, or even when they're focusing on, say, AIDS and preventing AIDS, it really matters exactly how they're trying to do that. So here's an example with two different blindness charities. So it cost about $40,000 to provide a guide dog to someone. So this is a figure, they range from about $40,000 to $60,000. You can find this out very easily by just going to some of the guide dog charities, and they're quite open about this on their websites. About $40,000, and that will provide a guide dog which will live for some period of time. I'm not sure exactly how long, I think it's between 10 or 20 years, and will provide benefit to someone who's blind. However, the costs, according to the World Health data, on how much it costs to completely cure someone of trachoma-induced blindness is about $20. So if you donated $40,000, you could either provide one guide dog, or you could completely cure about 2,000 people. So that's an example of this huge discrepancy. This is a somewhat odd example, because I'm comparing a developed world intervention, providing a guide dog to someone, say, in the UK, to helping people in other countries. A lot of people don't want to compare across borders like that, but I think it's the natural way to do it if you think that people's lives are developed. But could we take this idea further and not just look at, say, blindness, but try to look at the whole of health? And how do we compare apples and oranges in these cases? Like, how do we compare, say, saving a life to cure blindness? So there's a way that this is done in applied ethics or in health economics. And people started with this question, how many lives can we save? But there is this problem, that this truism that no one has ever saved a life. So you think that you can save a life. So suppose someone's having a heart attack, rush over and you zap them with the electric things, and they jolt back into a normal rhythm. But lo and behold, 30 years later, they die of cancer, or 40 years later, they die of something else. Everyone so far dies. The question is when they die. So how many years of life can you add to the person? So it would really matter if you were to, say, avoid their heart attack, but they were going to die 5 minutes later, say, a stab wound. Curing that heart attack would be less important than curing a heart attack for someone who was going to live for another 20 years. Because it matters for the person how long they live. And you can think of that from your own perspective. If you're only going to live for another 5 minutes, that would matter a lot less than if you're going to live. So the first point is that we can extend lives. So we can maybe ask this different question: how many life years can we save? But then there's also this point about what is the quality of that life? And this is pretty clear consideration. So it could be that you have an option of treatment for cancer, but your quality of life would be much lower if you're treated with an aggressive chemotherapy, but you might be able to live longer. And that's a trade-off that you have to think about for yourself, as to whether the extra quantity of life is outweighs the lower quality. Similarly, there's a question about treatments that are not life extending. For example, we talked earlier about curative blindness. So then you could look at a life, let's say 40 years of life, which is blind, you know, where you've got that health state of being blind, or 40 years of life where you're perfectly healthy. And it's obviously better to be perfectly healthy. But that's not a case of adding years on. We need to factor in quality somehow. And the kind of obvious way to do it turns out to work pretty well, which is to multiply by some number representing the quality. So we talk about how many quality-adjusted life years we can save. They take into account both the quality and the quantity. It's the standard approach in public health, and they're known as qualies or delies. There are some technical differences between qualies and delies, which would stand for disability-adjusted life years, but they're not very interesting. And I'll just talk about qualies instead. So just to sketch out, you know, this approach. So this is a schematic of a life here. This person lives from 0 to 70 or to 80 years, their quality of life changes over time, tracing out a curve here. This is perhaps a period of decline into ill health in middle age, and then recovery, and then several slow declines, followed by rapid decline at the end. You can imagine a curve like this. In general, they're going to be much more approximate than this, because we can't get very accurate data about this. Here are like some schematics, and here's the kind of way that you would use this idea. Suppose there's two different interventions you can perform. One of them improves a life from birth to death by, let's say, moves it from 70% quality to 90% quality. Another one improves it by 10 years, from 60 years to 70 years of life, the same quality. Well, you can just look at the area of these two rectangles to work out which one adds more quality adjusted life years, and that's a measure of this. It turns out that there are some kind of further maths people in the audience. There are some interesting technical reasons why this works as simply as it does. And if you did that, you'd find that this first one is 12 quality adjusted life years, and the second one is worth 7 quality adjusted life years. So the real benefit of these is that we can compare apples and oranges within the area of health. This is a tool for doing that. They're only a rough measure. There are a whole lot of surveys done where they try to put disability weights on these things. So they say, how bad is it to have chronic anemia? How bad is it to be paralyzed? And they ask people their trade-offs. How much, you know, if you can either have 10 years of life and perfect health, or you can have 20 years of life blind, which would you prefer? And they ask people all the questions like this. And if they prefer, let's say, 20 years of life blind, then they say that the quality of life in the blind must be at least up to 0.5. And they narrow it down after asking all the questions like this. The next natural question is, how much is one of these qualities worth? And an interesting thing, if you're in the UK, is that the NHS is prepared to spend £20,000 per quality. There's a group called NICE, National Institute of Excellence, who work this stuff out. And this is when it comes to new pharmaceuticals. They say we're only going to fund them. We'll definitely fund them if they cost less than £20,000 per year, and we will definitely not fund them if they cost more than £30,000. And if they cost in between, we'll look at some extra features. And one way to think about this is that because there's 8,760 hours in a year, this is about £2.30 per hour of health life. So that's a way to put it onto a scale that's easy to understand. How much would you spend? Do you think these are reasonable numbers? Kind of a show of hands for people who would spend, you know, if I could give you 5 hours of healthy life for £10, you know, you would think that's a good idea? I know that if there was someone on call market reliably selling hours of healthy life at this price, I would be very tempted. Other than my charitable obligations, I would use a lot of my spending money to buy hours of healthy life at that price. If you compare that to going to see a film or something, which costs much more than that, and all it does is kind of upgrade one normal hour into like a film hour, I would much rather just get entire additional hours that I can, you know, fill with whatever I want, like typically involving all the things like reading books, which is actually free. Another way to think about this is if you had a choice between a salary of £20,000 per annum and being perfectly healthy, or a salary of £30,000 per annum for the rest of your life, but it won't. If you prefer, I would prefer to get £20,000 and be able to remain to go to sea than to get £30,000 blind. And because the standard blindness weights which you used are about half, that would suggest that that I value a quality adjusted life here more than £20,000 per year. So there's a few different ways of trying to get at this. And I think that it's pretty plausible that it really is worth this much. For people who earn as much as we do in the UK, that £20,000 is a good deal for a hold for us. Now, another question, though, we've looked at what's worth, but a separate question is how much does it cost, right? So some things are worth more than they cost, which is why we buy them. So can we gain the quality for less than this? So let's look at the case of HIV or AIDS and preventing or curing it. We all know that it's a major toll in developing countries in particular. But there are heaps of different approaches to dealing with this, so let's look at a few of them. So here is a comparison of two different approaches. So Kaposi's sarcoma is an AIDS-defining illness, which is a skin condition that you don't get unless your immune system has been so compromised that we say that your HIV has progressed to be called AIDS. There is surgical treatment. And in comparison down here, we have antiretroviral therapy, which is much more effective. This is a case where longer bars of beta in proportion to how long they are. And what you can see here is how many quality adjusted life years per £1,000. Now that's pretty good if you get your whole quality adjusted life year for £1,000, because we were just talking about £20,000 is what we think they're worth more. And this here is the £20,000 per quality barrier. So a bar would have to be longer than that for the NHS to definitely fund. As it happens, they do fund treatment for Kaposi's sarcoma, that's around about their limit. And I think it's a good thing that they do fund it, because for people in the UK, we think it's worth that for us. Now, if we zoom out, though, we can look at another thing, prevention of transmission of HIV during pregnancy. This is really effective, partly because you can narrow down the time that you need to strike, and you just need to avoid, just have this small window where you don't have transmission, and then you get to save an entire life free from AIDS, as opposed to antiretroviral drugs, we have to provide them every year and quite expensive. So this is quite a bit more cost effective again, and we can barely see the effectiveness of treating Kaposi's sarcoma in comparison. And if we zoom out again, we can compare it to distribution of condoms, is much more effective again. And if we zoom out again, this is something that's not for HIV/AIDS, but this is one of the things that's about as effective as we know of, which is distribution of bed medicine. Malaria. And so this is an interesting kind of example of the cost-effectiveness landscape. And what you're really meant to remember from this is that some things are just way more cost-effective than others. And also, pretty much everything on here is really quite cost-effective, as that line shows us. That's the barrier needed to reach. It's not the case that this is all right and these things are scams or something like that. What I'm trying to show you is that this thing is all right and these things are amazing. So, health programs in developing countries can be amazingly cost-effective, about 1,000 times more than we get here. So instead of something like £20,000 per quality, we can get things more like £20 per quality, possibly even cheaper. We're doing research on this. And something like 1,000 times more effective than is needed to be a good deal. So even if it was 1,000th as effective, we would pay for it for ourselves. And this shows us that our money's worth much more than we might have thought it is. Each £5 to £30 that you have in the pocket is worth a year of healthy life, but only if it's used on the best programs, and only if it's not used on you, because you're going to have free access to these really effective things, or you're in an area where malaria has been eradicated, and to solve the problem. So. But our money's worth a very large amount if we spend our lives and spend it effectively. So, these differences and the data I looked at is mainly used in the world by policymakers. People at WHO trying to tell people in poor countries how they should spend their health budget, and trying to tell people in rich countries how they should donate money through their aid agencies in order to help poor countries. But it's also of interest to us, because when we donate money, we're trying to help people and to help them as much as possible. And suppose we want to donate money to fight AIDS. It really matters whether that's used to fund treatment of Kaposi's sarcoma or to fund condom distribution. It's not enough, actually, to just hear someone say, donate to this campaign to 5/8, you really want to find out what they're using. And you might think they'll just be using the most effective thing, but you'd be surprised. A lot of the time they're not. A lot of the people who are running these organizations are not familiar with this type of analysis. And they think that they're, let's say, they're treating Kaposi's sarcoma as effectively as possible. They don't know anyone in their kind of circle who can cure it for cheaper than they can. So they consider themselves to be very effective, but they haven't done this kind of wider comparison. And if we're interested in finding the most effective AIDS charity we can find, why not look further and say, why did we focus on AIDS? Why aren't we just trying to help people? Why discriminate against people who have other diseases? Why not take them all equally and just look at who we can help the most effectively? Another thing that really follows from this is this idea that where to give can be even more important than whether to give. So consider these three options. First one is to donate nothing at all. The second one is to save 100 quality adjusted life years by funding HIV transmission prevention. And the third one is to save 700 qualities by funding malaria nets. Now the difference between these two here is 600 years of life. And the difference between these two is only 100 years of life. So whereas the normal person, when thinking about this, where they're not familiar with this type of discrepancies of effectiveness, would think, well, this is pretty bad. Doing either of these, is fine. You're doing something good. But actually, there's a much bigger difference between these than there is between those. This one here is not halfway to being like as good as you can be. Another thing to bear in mind about this is that we can do amazing things. While living in your own country, doing whatever career you want to do, and living an affluent lifestyle, you can still do a huge amount to help people. A lot of people imagine that in order to help, you've got to go to a poor country and live a much more difficult lifestyle, be away from your friends and family, and maybe take up a career that you didn't want to take up. But what I'm trying to say is that even while having all those great features in your life, if you were to donate 10% of your future income, you could still have all of those things and could save at least 3,000 years of healthy life, or 3 millennia of life at perfect health. It's a really big thing. So I thought about this, and I considered my options. So one option was to spend £1.5 million on myself, live the standard kind of affluent, middle-class UK lifestyle. And this other option was to spend £500,000 on myself and donate £1 million to others. And I chose the second one. It's still a great quality of life. As I said before, it has pretty much everything that one would think is a good life. I can save at least 30,000 quality adjusted life years, or 300 centuries of perfectly healthy life, while having this kind of great life with all of these great aspects. So you might be wondering, how can this be possible? Is this too good to be true? And I think that this slide helps to explain what's going on there. So this is the world income distribution. I think it's the most important chart in all of economics. You don't see it very often, though. A lot of people are more focused on the financial crisis or something. But this shows the financial crisis is nothing compared to what else is going on in the world economically and with the current regimes reinforcing this. But here we've lined everyone in the world up from poorest to richest. And the height of the line at any point is how much income that person has. This chart has been adjusted to take into account the fact that money goes further in poorer countries. So you might think, well, these people here only have 1/50th of the people here, but it goes a lot further in those countries. But that's already been adjusted for. So that's called it's US dollars purchasing power parity adjusted. And it's income per household member. So you take the household income and divide it by the number of people in the house. As you can see, it's incredibly unequally distributed. To all intents and purposes, everyone really below the 70th percentile having almost nothing compared to people above. But what's interesting is that all of you and me will be in the richest 2% of the world income distribution in your lives. This is, in fact, probably you'll be in the richest 1%. It's interesting to compare with the Occupy movement, because in terms of the global income distribution, we are the 1% to them, or at least 2%. And a lot of the people who are protesting are going to be in the 1 or 2% globally. And this is something that there's a lot fewer protests about, it is actually a bigger deal. And it's because these people, have so little money, and we have so much money. That's why it is that by giving up a relatively small portion of our money, we're able to help them so much, because we have tens or hundreds of times as much money. So it turns out that giving away 10% of it, that is more than the entire amount that these people will earn. And then by giving it away to the most effective organizations, we can actually spend even more effectively than they can. So we can find very targeted things, which they can't easily buy. An example of that might be a deworming program, where it gets much more cost effective to run a deworming program at a school and have all the students go and take a pill than it is to sell pills in a shop and have each person come in and buy them individually. So because we've got access to some interventions like this, we can actually spend the money better than they can in some cases. So this takes us to giving what we can, which is my response to all of this. So I thought about this, I became familiar with a lot of these figures, I looked up quite a lot of them myself in about 2005, I decided I was going to donate about 2/3 of my income over my life, in particular to donate everything above £18,000 per annum. I decided that was enough for me to get by on. In fact, it was enough for me to get by on and also to contribute to a mortgage. I thought all about this and tried to work out whether I should rent for the rest of my life, whether that would be more effective than buying a house, but I decided to buy a house and then when I get to about retirement, to start spending down the capital on the house, basically to die without the house, donating the house. This is not that hard to do financially. Basically, it looked like it was going to be, I'm going to give slightly more money away over my whole life if I owned a house halfway through and then got rid of it in the end, compared to if I rented for a long time. But it's not actually clear that that's true. I encourage you to think about things like this besides. So overall, I'll be able to live on much less than £18,000. It's just that I needed to get the house early in order to get that thing to work. Give what we can is a society of people who care really strongly about improving the lives of people in developing countries. Maybe they're willing to think about things like the idea of renting for the rest of your life, or questions like that. How are we practically going to manage things in order to really go help people as much as they can? Each member makes a pledge to donate at least 10% of their income to wherever it is that they think can most effectively help people. So we care both about helping give more, both giving more and giving more effectively. And we run a website that collects and shares information about how people can do that, and helps to show people the answers to questions about how does giving away a lot of money affect your happiness? Does it increase it or decrease it? Is there really much of a sacrifice to be made? If there's a financial sacrifice, is there actually a sacrifice in your well-being? Actually, there's a spoiler, it looks like there isn't. So in that case, it's a bit of a no-brainer to do this thing. And a nice way to illustrate these two different aims is with this chart, where we've got here the percent given, and the first idea is to get them to give more, that's to improve the impact that they're having by getting them to give more, so they'll have more impact. And then the second idea is to get them to give more effectively, which pushes out this way. I don't know if you guys see Dead Poets Society, that's too early for you guys, but there's a chart like this in there. As you can see, the total impact that you can have increases as the product of these two things. So it's really important to be able to do both of them. If you just did one or just did the other, you will achieve a lot less than half of what you achieve if you did both. This is an update. That's always a nice surprise. I think we currently have about 340 members who have pledged more than $140 million now. And this comes to something from about 3 to 16 million older adjusted life years in terms of the lifetime pledge of all the members, which is pretty cool, I think. We have local chapters here at Oxford and also at Cambridge, London, Princeton, Harvard, Rutgers, San Diego, Canberra, and possibly some other places. You can find out more about this at givingwhatwecan.org. In conclusion, here are exceptionally wealthy compared to people in developing countries. And we should take that very seriously, but we shouldn't just beat ourselves up about it. And a lot of talks end with people, you know, beating themselves up about that and going home and feeling bad. That's not how I want to end this talk. The point is that we're like really comparatively powerful for reasons that we did nothing to deserve. And that means that we can help people because through no kind of fault or kind of good work of our own, we've ended up in very powerful positions, which we can use to help people by a vast amount. Our money can do hundreds of times more for them than it can for us because we're already very rich and we've already gained the really effective things in our lives. But only if it's given really wisely. There's this point about where to give is even more important than whether to give. And the world is an unfair place with a great deal of suffering, but we can each do a tremendous amount to help make it better. And I urge you to do so. We have this pledge to give 10%, and also there's an idea that we're experimenting with called trying out giving. And we have forms for this at the back if anyone is interested, where you can, instead of making a pledge over the rest of your life to, or until you retire to give 10%, you can try out a smaller pledge, for example, for the next year or until I finish my degree. I'm going to try out giving 5% of my spending money. To see if you can do this. So I encourage you to think about that as well. If you like the idea but not ready to make the big plunge. Thank you. And I'm happy to take all the questions until we run out of time. And then inform all questions possible. Anyone? Got any questions? Yes?
Do you know anything about how quality just the life is calculated?
So, as I said, the main issue that you probably need to do is how to do the quality wave, so the vertical scale. The horizontal scale is just the number of years. There are several different methods for doing it. The basic idea is that you survey a lot of people, ideally people who have time to think about the question. You get occasionally some bad surveys where they just ask people very quickly to come up with answers to these things. But then there are, I think, about three different ways of doing it. One is called visual analog scale, where you just give them a line that goes from 0 to 1, and you say, you know, can you put a mark in here where you say being deaf is? And now can you put a mark in here where you say suffering moderate pain in the morning scan is? And so on. You ask for all of these things. And that's not a great measurement. That was decent enough in the early days, but we can do better than that now. They have these other methods like the time trade-off, where, as I said earlier, you ask them if you could either have 10 years of perfectly healthy life, or you could have some larger number of years of life with a certain condition they're describing, how many years would you have for a particular good? That's the time trade-off. And there's another method called the standard gamble, where you ask if you could either be blind from now on, or you could have a chance of dying, 10% chance of just dying. Which would you rather? And then they ask, you know, what about a 12% chance or a 5% chance? You know, ask for different numbers and find out where they would be different. And then they say, you know, if they say that they would be willing to accept a 10% chance of dying to avoid being blind, and then more, that's like saying that being blind is worth 90% of the quality of life that's being perfectly healthy. So there's a couple of different measures. They give slightly different results. So I wouldn't think that the quality gradients are precisely accurate. You know, if the number I saw somewhere was, say, 80%, I would think, maybe it's 70%, maybe it's 90%. I'm not really sure. But when you combine that with the empirical data about how much more effective some things are than other things, it turns out that some of these interventions are 10 times as effective as others, or 100 times as effective as others. And so an issue as to whether it would actually 70% quality of life or 80% kind of balances out in the wash when you get those really large discrepancies. And I think that's actually what you mean. What has meant that a lot of people haven't really taken this stuff seriously. They've thought, how could you measure this? How could you compare different health states and different forms of cure to each other? It sounds impossible. And it sounds impossible to do very accurately. But what's interesting is that you don't need to be very accurate in order to actually get really action-guiding information from it, because some other things are so different. You know, it would have to be that one health state is 100 times worse than another in order to justify funding its treatment. Other questions?
Yes, on average, how many charities do you guys analyze or assess on a yearly basis? And do charities approach you, or do you go and...
We get a bit of both, although we mainly like to approach charities rather than the other way around, because we're interested in trying to find the very best ones. And to do that based on the evidence that exists around them. So to look through the evidence and find that, for example, long-lasting insecticide-treated bed nets are very effective. So who is distributing them? Look at several groups who are distributing them, try to find out who we trust the most or who has the most efficiencies in their pipeline and so on. And we found that AMF are particularly good. Last week, perhaps, and let's see, yes, malaria foundation, and so we're often focused on the intervention first, and then we try to find out who's doing it. I'm not sure of the numbers of particular charities that we assess each year. It's probably something between like 3 to 10, to give a ballpark.
Really, really care about problems, some of the problems you've been talking about, would it not be best use of your time, perhaps your money as well, to lobby governments to change the way they give international aid?
It could be. I do that as well. It's not clear. It's actually very interesting if you're here in Britain. The Conservative government has had a big focus on what they call value for money, and that is actually pretty much exactly what we're talking about when we talk about cost effectiveness. I think that there's a kind of idea, if you hear the phrase value for money, you think more. We want to make sure these donors are getting their value for money, we're protecting the donors or something. But that's just the kind of spin on it. I think it's equally applicable. You know, it's the same concept, which is you want to get as much as possible for the amount you put in. And that's relevant from a moral perspective to help people as much as possible. If I'm going to donate £1 million over my life, I want to help, you know, twice as many people if I can. So I really care about that. So there has been a big impetus on that. The type of thing I talk to different about this and try to do what I can to nudge them to effective treatments. And it could be that some larger things, you know, maybe trying to change world trade policy. Through lobbying, you get a very large amount of leverage, perhaps. It's a lot harder to assess some of those things when you've got a small chance of a huge return, because there's not much of a track record to go on. Maybe you could look at something like ending slavery. That's something that had a kind of small chance of a huge return, which actually worked. Although you have to look into the details and find out whether it was the type of thing whose time had come socially, or whether it was the fact that a few people managed to make it happen before its time. Yeah, we take these things seriously, although it's harder to get some hard figures on them. In general, we don't think that it's obvious that health charities are more effective than other ways of helping people in poor countries. It could be that, say, education could be more effective, or fighting corruption could be more effective, or trying to overturn trade policy could be more effective, perhaps other things. I don't know. But what we do know is that we're able to kind of, within health, to find some of the most effective things. Which is quite nice, whereas in the other areas we have less light to see by to work out what's the most correct. So that's why most of our recommendations are there. But we would love to go and extend more into other areas as well.
It is something you have to think carefully about, though, because if you convince one person who learns a lot more in their lifetime than you to learn the same or even a smaller percentage, you could. I'm not saying you shouldn't do both.
Yeah, I think that's right. So there are potentials to help a lot by, for example, when it comes to high net worth individuals, there have a lot of people approaching them already to give money. So it's not as easy as it seems. There are a lot of charities who already spend a lot of their budgets, their outreach budgets, approaching such people. But trying to start a movement to try to get other people. Means or people with very high incomes to give could be a very effective thing to do.
I'm really sorry that I came in late because of the class, so if this was already answered, just ignore it and tell me later.
Sure.
But I'm really curious in terms of your personal decision to do this. How do you deal with sort of thoughts about insecurity in the future? Financial insecurity, welfare state, children, house, all that kind of thing. It just seems really hard for me to contemplate thinking ahead and calculating, you know, rent versus mortgage. Who
yeah.
knows what rent's going to be like in 50 years?
Yeah, that's right.
So
that's pretty much what happened to my spreadsheet, unfortunately, is that I had ended up with a term in there for, like, what's going to happen to interest rates. And it turns out that if they're high enough, you know, then one of these things becomes better, and if they're low enough, the other one becomes better, and it was very hard to get much progress beyond that. But basically, the way I think about it is this, which is that I was spending in today's terms, so kind of inflation adjusted, about something like £10,000 or £12,000 per annum, and I was living a fine life in Oxford that was just like really nice. And now I've got £18,000 per annum to spend, and that's a lot more. You know, I could lose a third of that, and I would still have as much money as I had before. I've been saving that by investing it in my house, and I've been saving some of it, and paying off the mortgage, and that's created a buffer. So I feel pretty secure, and I've managed to donate something like £50,000 to some of the charities that we recommend, while feeling quite secure. It's quite nice if you choose to do this type of thing early in your life, particularly while you're a student, which is what was the case with me, because then you know that you're going to be earning a lot more than 10% more, you know, later than you are now. In my case, where I start to give everything above £18,000. £18,000 is a lot higher than that's what I was earning. And obviously, I'm giving more than 10% as well. If I did start earning £17,000, I would still give 10%. I think that it's quite a lot of money. And there's something that strikes me as really sad if you get a whole lot of altruistic people and they're all kind of so worried about these kind of like unlikely scenarios that they don't help people in poor countries who are just obviously much poorer than them. And who are themselves facing a whole lot of risky scenarios. So it could be the case that I think maybe in the future my wife will get a condition which is really rare and which the NHS won't treat, which would cost, you know, £100,000 to be able to treat her, and I wouldn't have that money, and what would I do, or my child? And that you can have a lot of these kind of what-if things. But there's even more chance that such things will happen to the poor people who are trying to help. So I feel, you know, okay with making this decision. Another thing is that here's an interesting point, I think, which is that a lot of people, this occurs to a lot of people when they're thinking about whether to give to charity or not, but it doesn't occur to them when they're thinking about whether to earn a lot of money or not. So if you've thought at some point in your life, should I go into finance or go into, maybe not finance, but some other area where I get a large amount of money, maybe management consultancy or something, a lot of people say, I want to live the vision of my life and do what I think, you know, is kind of right by myself. So I'm not going to do that. But they don't think, well, what if my child gets sick and I need that extra £100,000 in order to pay for it? The only way I could have got that money is if I was a management consultant. That never occurs to people when they're imagining kind of a normal life and then getting more money. It only really occurs to them when they're imagining having less money. And so I think there's something funny going on in the way we're thinking about it, and where it just ultimately end up being biased towards ourselves or something. I'm not exactly sure, but there's some discrepancies in how we think about it. I definitely have had these thoughts, but I've managed to convince myself that I was thinking the wrong thing. I hope that helps a bit. Yep.
What do you think are the strongest critiques of getting what you can? Like, what do you think about those critiques?
Good question. I would rather hear one of them because, there are various critiques that are so strong that I agree with them, right? So people think that they're disagreeing with me, but actually they're agreeing with me. An example of that would be someone saying, you know, even what we can is just about health, and, you know, what about these other things? Maybe, you know, we need to fight the root of the problem, we need to do something about the system, and we need to deal with that. My response to that would be twofold. One is to say, yeah, that could well be right. If you think that that's a really important problem, maybe you want to spend your career working on that problem. Some people say, you know, you need to use your career. And I'd also say, if you think it's that important, then you should use your whole career. some of these systemic things. And then it actually doesn't look like they're in that much disagreement with me. So I think that's what generally happens, is if someone says, well, it's not just about money, it's also about your time, I'd say, yeah, it's about both. I think that this type of argument here shows that money's worth a lot more than most people would have thought, and it's difficult to see exactly how your time can lead to such big benefits for other people. And what I've tried to show really is that the first thing you should do is I've given you an argument, take out your wallet and say, okay, like, I'm going to have to donate 10% of my money or something. And then there's a separate question, should I also give a whole lot of my time on these things? And maybe there are strong arguments that you should. I think it's actually a little bit harder to run those arguments. I think that asking people for 10% of their time is actually more of a sacrifice to that person than 10% of their money. But maybe you can do even more good. But only if it's done very effectively. One of the really nice things about donations is that it's actually this amazing thing. If you try to go to a poor country and try to help directly, maybe you help construct a school or something like that, you're doing something you're not very good at for people in a poor country. In fact, a poor country where labor is like fairly plentiful, and there are a lot of people who don't have very large incomes who could be doing that construction. And I remember at one point I thought to myself, wouldn't it be great if there was some system whereby you pair people up with charities such that whatever skills you had, if we'd let you use them as well as possible to help those poor people. So if you're really good at computer programming, it let you use your computer programming to help poor people. If you're really good at some other area, let you do that. But that's actually what the charity sector is. The idea is that you do whatever it is that you want in your career that's the best combination of like personal satisfaction and income earning. And then that gives you money, which you then can spend. So if you're really good at computer programming, you'll get a high salary in computer programming, and then you can donate that salary to people who are really good at building houses, and they will build the houses or whatever it is. So while it feels kind of crass to talk about money, it is actually a very useful system to help people in all places. Any more questions?
I was talking to a friend about these ideas, and he's sufficiently convinced that he's not spending some of his time trying to convince other people, but he said to me one time that he thought of a snag in the argument that he wasn't sure about, and it was that if he donated his money to help somebody in an impoverished nation, then they would continue with their life, for instance, living on trash heap, collecting resources from that, except they wouldn't have parasites or they wouldn't have malaria. Whereas he could spend that money to go to Paris and go to the Louvre and see amazing artworks. So his basic point was that although he could help this person, their life wouldn't contain any more of the things that he valued, like reading books or seeing amazing artworks.
So I think that the flaw in his argument is that he's going to have trouble getting to the Louvre for 50 pence, which is what it costs to treat a child with parasites. And if he scales it up and says, okay, well, admittedly that's true, but I would be able to help 200 children or something, for the kind of cheapest price to get to the Louvre and to look at the paintings and come back again. Then it becomes quite a lot less clear because you're helping 200 people avoid this problem. You are adding several years of life to these people. These people will have worthy projects. They'll have lovers. People they care desperately about. There'll be people who care desperately about them. And those people's lives will be really improved by having this extra time to have many of the kind of classic things about the human condition, the good things as well. Yeah. Also, you kind of try to imagine what the other people would think about the Louvre argument if you ran it by them and said, look, guys, I've thought about this, and so it seems to me that what's really important is seeing these great artworks, and you guys aren't going to be doing any of that, so I'm going to keep the money. I can't imagine that there would be like universal agreement with that. It's like it's obvious, yeah, that's right, you've worked that out, haven't you? I often try to run things past that kind of perspective. Like, if I were to talk to the people, the beneficiaries of talk it out with them. you know, what kind of conclusions would we come to? Maybe they wouldn't be aware of a certain thing. They would say, it is bad, that thing, I don't like it. You know, and I'd have to convince them that actually it does save lives, and you're not aware of the statistics on this, but they've been wiped out, and it's actually very effective. And so I kind of figured, you know, if they could accept that, then they'd probably go along with it. And in some cases, I find this approach of focusing on the beneficiary first is really useful and illuminating. So for example, some people don't like giving what we can because they think that you should be very quiet about your giving, and you shouldn't tell anyone. Whereas the idea of giving what we can is more like a petition or a public pledge to say, you know, we think that there's real problems in the world between the poor countries and the rich countries, and you know, maybe we disagree internally about exactly what should be done about that. We have different political views and things, but we, you know, we're all willing to put our money where our mouths are. Say, look, this is a serious issue. I'm willing to, you know, use 10% of my entire income trying to do what I can to help deal with this. I hope others will too, and you know, trying to raise awareness like that, get people talking about it, get people interested, and show people that we care. Whereas it can be a lot more difficult, I think, to do that. It can be more difficult for some people to donate if they think no one else is. So partly the idea is to cure that by showing that some people are. So when I think about that, and then I imagine, yeah, it's the case that more money will be donated if we're public about our giving than if we're private about it. And so more people in poor countries will have their lives improved by this. And then if I try to imagine what those people think, would they rather that I was quiet about my giving and that, you know, several of their friends or family, you know, suffer from additional parasites or early death and so on. But at least, you know, Toby was private about his giving. I just don't think that they would buy that at all. I don't think that that's, you know, how many lives is it worth dying so that I can be virtuous by not telling people about my giving? The answer is going to be one.
So how does giving what we can balance the most effective causes and the most important causes? How do you balance that? Because for a community, a particular community, maybe the most important thing is addressing malaria. Mm-hmm. But the most effective or the most cost-effective mm-hmm. one is maybe is. So how do you balance that?
Yeah, so I'm trying to work out exactly what you mean by important. So is the biggest one, is that
yes.
The idea? Yeah. So
the one at the heart of a community.
Okay.
Yeah.
So my approach is to try to do what I can to help people, help as many people by as much as possible. And so it might be, for example, that's not something which is at the heart of the community. So I'll give you an example. So in Oxford, if we try to look at what in our community are the kind of big issues, we might think, for example, to go past a lot of homeless people in the street. Maybe homelessness is a big social issue in Oxford. Maybe lack of affordable housing is another big issue. But suppose there was someone in Oxford, just one person who had a rare illness, which they couldn't treat, but let's say I could fix it for them. For some small amount of money, then it seems to me that even though that's not like the big issue in Oxford, but if I could work on that more effectively than anything else, that's what I should be working on. I could, you know, help turn this person's life around. So I think that in some cases, it can be that there are things which are not the biggest issues, but which are more effectively dealt with. Economists would say it's kind of more effective on the margin, and as in if you could just do a little bit more, how much impact would you? We shouldn't, of course, be blind to things where maybe if we could get enough money together, we could make maybe something that's even more effective, but you need to put in a lot at once in order to get it to happen. So I definitely want to take that very seriously. At the moment, the total amount of money that Giving What We Can members are able to donate each year is just in the kind of single millions of dollars. So it's not, it's not like a vast amount that we'll be able to do some huge thing at once. If it were, then did that answer your question? Okay, thanks.
Does Giving What We Can do any research into how it can be most effective at encouraging effective giving? So, for example, there's the Giving What We Can pledge, mm-hmm. which is quite specific, and what other things consider, and so on. And
yeah.
How do you get about that?
We certainly spend a lot of time thinking about it and trying to work out if we want to help people, you know, in poor countries as much as possible, what should we do? And I thought about this for quite a long time before launching the organization and decided that building around a pledge would be a good idea. percent pledge was chosen for a number of reasons, including the connection to tithing, and it's often been a historical figure. And it's also a round number. I've said it's 11.7%. Everyone would look at me funny and said, justify yourself. That is a large enough amount that it's clear that people are being really serious about it, but it's not too big an ask. If you remember that chart we had a little while ago about how rich most of the people we run pitches to are, i.e. people in rich countries, are typically going to be here. If you're a poor person in a rich country, maybe you'll be there. If you have a look, the median income in the UK, this is after-tax income. The median after-tax income is about £16,000, which is about here. So that's like the 50th, the typical person in the UK is like somewhere around there. It does depend on exactly whether they've got children at home or whether they've left home and things like that. But at some point in their life, they'll be up here and maybe sometime going down. And we're all very wealthy. So if we had 10% less money, so if we moved us down that much, we would still often be the richest few percent. I tried this when I was here on a rather meager scholarship from Balliol College, where I was living on £8,000 per annum. I don't know how that compares to the standard undergraduate allowances. We've got a calculator on our website, which I got the data for from various sources and put it together. That showed that I was in the richest 10% of the world's population, living as a student on a rather small stipend that my friends and family were surprised that I could live on at all. Because you're already doing it. And it's just interesting that even if I gained 10%, I would still be in the richest 10% of the world's population, even living on this relatively small scholarship. That was a real eye-opener for me. And we chose 10% in part because we thought, therefore, that it is achievable for a lot of people. And we have definitely tried out a few other things. We haven't, don't think we've conducted any formal experiments on it. But in fact, this program of trying out giving is part of that, is trying to say, well, what's a way that we want to have a kind of signature pledge that we can all kind of get together around, rather than some of our members do X, some do Y, some do Z, but to try to get people thinking about that, try something out, make it seem a bit more approachable. If you have any ideas, then run them through the Give What We Can Oxford committee.
Is there a standard way of doing it in terms of, you may have already said that, but do people have sort of like a standing order from their own account into their personal donation account at the beginning of the, I'm just thinking sort of in terms of behavioral economics, how do you do this to make people feel?
I think that's a good question. We don't talk much about that on the website or generally. Everyone kind of works out themselves, but it would actually be easier to have some streamlined. I've only recently started I set up an extra bank account within my account, which is like my charity savings account. Once I realized I could do this without attracting any more fees, and then I have a thing where every month a certain amount is moved in, and so I can save up the amount. And that definitely was a smart move. It also means that basically, then the amount of money you see in your spending account is the amount of money you can spend. And if you run out of it, it's not that you don't end up giving. It's that you end up eating less good food for a bit or something like that, or going without something that you planned on having if you fail to budget properly. So it's nice getting to kind of abstract those things away. You could probably have more suggestions about things like that. It's also possible for people to, I think one option is to give to the donor advice fund that we've first set up. Can you say something on that, Michelle?
So it's actually called a Charity Cross, because it's a UK thing, and it's essentially a really scaled down version of a charity. We've just set it up because previously we encouraged people to give direct to the charity we recommended, so that they knew that we weren't taking a cut, whatever. But the nice thing about the Charitable Trust is it's super easy. You can just set up a direct debit to it or pay in various other ways. And then we distribute it to our recommended charities. So it's a nice easy way of giving to all of our recommended charities, or choosing which of those you want to give to, and it's on the website. I think, in fact, it went up today, possibly tomorrow.
It will be like in a couple of days, yeah.
Okay. And so an advantage of something like that is that, a direct debit can be quite a convenient way of doing things. I hadn't been giving like that because I liked to be able to give to wherever I currently thought was most effective, and I would feel really bad about turning off a direct debit. So it had some kind of psychological pull to, behavioral economics point, to giving to a place which I no longer thought was as effective as possible. So I thought that I would go with an approach of just at the end of every financial year to just sit down for a while, look at the evidence, see what the current state of the play was, and what we can do, and then choose where I want to donate. And that's how I've been doing it. But another advantage is that if you think there are some potential advantages of giving earlier and some potential advantages of giving later in life, I think the biggest advantage of giving earlier in life is that you can help encourage other people, inspire other people to do so, and do it together as a group. And also that you'll actually do it, whereas I think most people who decide they're going to give later in their life don't. So it's a nice kind of commitment device that you will give as well. Advantages of giving later can include that maybe you'll have more information about where are the most effective places. Whereas if you donate through this charitable trust that we've set up, you can potentially get the best of both worlds by giving earlier and then deciding for it to be dispersed later to a charity that people can recommend in 5 years' time. Is that actually possible?
Yeah, it is. Sorry, I was just going to say, and another thing is that because it's like a scaled-down charity, it can get gift aid even if the money goes to an American charity.
That's a big advantage.
So Project Healthy Children and DUM are both US charities, and the trust has to do a bit of paperwork, but it can then get gift aid on those things, which like may not be relevant at the moment if you're all students, but it's a big
advantage. But I should also say that each country has its own idiosyncratic way of dealing with tax policy about giving, and so if you're in the UK, then gift aid means that you get an additional 25%, is that right, given by the government on top of what you normally give. So for example, if you give £8, the government gives an extra £2, taking total up to £10. And we count that as part of your 10%. It's actually only 8% plus if you give the gift aid. The reason for that, might be, that's a bit odd, why didn't you count that 8%? The reason for that is that in America, they do it by a tax deduction. It would seem odd to people if we require that they then re-donate the tax deduction and then re-donate the deduction on the deduction and so on. If you calculate it all out, you get the same thing. So, but basically, the way it works is that in effect, if you're earning income, you won't be able to give any other terms of your education. Is that all?
Yeah.
Have a few more drinks and.